Welcome to a special edition of All About Wine on Blog Talk Radio. With your host, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida Estates Winery in Land O'Lakes, Florida.
First, we were talking last week about Asian wineries and Asian grapes. We're going to finish up Australia today. That's what we're doing with the French. So we're continuing with France tonight. Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly. Mike and I were talking about the possibilities of hooking up with different wineries in different states and finding out what's going on. Sounds like it might be a whole lot of fun.
Well, Southwest Wine is actually located in Deming, New Mexico.
Well, La Viña is the oldest winery in New Mexico.
Castello di Borghese, the first winery established in Long Island.
Blackhead Lake Winery, and we're located at Glacier Park in Montana.
Camas Prairie Winery in Moscow, Idaho.
Brotherhood is America's oldest winery since 1839.
Ithaca, New York, College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Grapesandwine.cal.cornell.edu.
The website is freethegrapes.org.
Holy Field Vineyard and Winery in Bastyr, Kansas.
Organic Farm on the coast of Maine near Mount Desert Island.
Westport Rivers, Westport, Mass.
HaverHill.com. The Napa Valley of the Midwest.
RainbornWines.com in Santa Rosa.
Ten Spoon in Montana.
Alba Vineyards.
We're the largest estate vineyard in New Jersey.
Heritage Vineyards and Winery, New Jersey's top-rated winery for 2011.
Andea Vineyards on Route 93. That's the main highway coming right up the center of New Hampshire out of Massachusetts.
Vivac Winery. We are actually the highest-rated red wines in New Mexico.
Phone lines are now open. Call the guest line at area code 646-727-3235. That's 646-727-3235. Call and chat with our special guest. And now, All About Wine on Blog Talk Radio. Here's Ron.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Got the bus people even today. Special bus trip in, just so they can listen to the program. Good.
Yep. I will be right back, and you go ahead and do what you got to do, and I'll see you in a minute.
Yeah, okay. Mike's going to go get our speaker, going to get a hold of him on the phone. We have a special speaker today. Thank you all for tuning in on our special program here. This is All About Wine. Our normal time slot is Thursday evenings Eastern Time from 7 to 8, 8:30. And as you heard at the beginning there, if you haven't followed us, we talk about wine. We talk to different wineries. We talk about wine around the country, around the world, everything. We've done a lot of stuff. If this is your first time listening, thanks for tuning in. We appreciate it. If you have any questions, any call-ins, any questions for our guest, 646-727-3235. Our guest today, we have a special guest. I'm excited about this. I'm really thrilled that Greg decided to join us because I'm looking forward to what he has to say. Our speaker today and our guest today is Gregory V. Jones. He is a professor of the Department of Environmental Studies at Southern Oregon University. Let me give you a little background, a little thing about Greg here. And this is actually from the website for Southern Oregon University. It says, Gregory Jones is a professor of research and climatologist in the Department of Environmental Studies at Southern Oregon University, who specializes in the study of climate structure and suitability for viticulture and how climate variability and change influence grapevine growth, wine production, and quality. He holds a BA and a PhD from the University of Virginia in Environmental Studies with a concentration in the atmospheric sciences. His teaching and research interests include meteorology, climatology, hydrology, and agriculture, phenology of plant systems, biosphere and atmosphere interactions, climate change, and quantitative methods in spatial and temporal analysis. His dissertation was on the climatology of viticulture in Bordeaux, France, with a focus on the spatial differences in grapevine phenology, grape composition and yield, and the resulting wine quality. He conducts applied research for the grape and wine industry in Oregon, has given hundreds of international, national, and regional presentations on climate and wine-related research. He is the author of numerous book chapters, including being a contributing author to the 2008 Nobel Peace Prize-winning Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Report and other reports and articles on wine, economics, grapevine phenology, site assessment methods for viticulture, climatological assessments of viticulture potential, and climate change. He has also helped helped in 25-plus publications. He has co-authored 9 or more books. He has written numerous reports, scientific reports on climatology. He has been author and helped with many different publications, different articles, different publications. He has been speakers at many different symposium stuff around the world. A list of awards, which I won't go into because there's just almost too many to list here. And his professional affiliations include Meteorology Society, Wine Economics, and all sorts of stuff. So we are going to talk to Greg. Actually, I would like to have Greg talk to us because he seems to have a lot to say for us today, I hope. So, hello, Greg, you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us. I am looking forward to what you have to say about climate, grapevines, soils, all the influence and everything. Climate. Since this is really in the front, and I've talked a lot about climate and how climate's affected vineyards around the world and individual pockets and all that, if you don't mind going into climates and the influence on grapevines.
Well, sure, and I really do hope it's just more than me speaking, and let's interact on this because I'm sure you have some good questions relative to the topic. But I guess just a broad background. I'm a climatologist, and I started most of my studies based upon looking at aspects of agriculture and trying to understand how both climate variability and structure influences agriculture. But what happened was I started studying the broad topic when I was an undergraduate student at the University of Virginia, and I found that what really interested me was the nature of growing grapes and making wine. It's very different than a broad acre crop like soybeans or corn or rice or wheat, you know, that has, arguably very important climate influences. But what really intrigued me about the relationship between producing wine and climate was the fact that it had a fairly narrow geography, which means that it has a fairly narrow climate that influences growing grapes and making wine. Now, the other piece of it is that not only is it across the entire spectrum of grape varieties for wine production that it's narrow, but it's also even more narrow when you start looking at individual varieties. So all of that kind of just drove my interest in trying to understand what we knew about it, and could we help define kind of those climate issues relative to growing grapes and making wine. Now, all that being said, again, I view that there's really four things that you have to kind of think about. You have to understand what is the climate structure in wine regions, or maybe even a place that doesn't grow grapes. But what is the climate structure that makes it conducive to growing grapes? Then what is the suitability factors that make a climate more or less suitable for a given variety or a given collection of varieties in different places in the world? The next piece would be how climate variability, year in, year out, or decadal kind of influences in climate drives variability in either plant growth characteristics and maybe production and maybe quality of the product that's produced. And then finally, the big issue, of course, has been of late, the discussion around climate change. How do climates change? And how has that influenced growing grapes and making wine over our past history and potentially in our future? So I tend to work across that whole entire spectrum, trying to understand structure, suitability, variability, and change in terms of climate and its relationship with growing grapes and making wine.
Greg, if I may, isn't that terroir? Isn't that the French terroir that you're speaking of there, basically, though?
Well, to some degree, the terroir is a, it's kind of a conundrum in some ways. It's a mystical conundrum that we have within the industry, both the industry as a producer and the industry as a scientific research interest. Terroir, it appears from the history of the use of the word terroir that it originally meant a region delimited by its agricultural potential. The etymology of the word goes back to terra or territory, which a lot of people took figuratively to mean land or soil or geology. But there's some really interesting ties back to terroir that are very seated in historic occurrences in Europe. Some of the early usage in the wine sector is based upon the Cistern monks out of Burgundy, where they established this idea that there was a terroir for growing grapes in their region. Today, they're even using a slightly different term to describe that terroir. They're calling it a climat, which essentially I gets back to my major point, is that climate is a very important factor in terroir. But the idea, if you go back, you know, to the early days of the Cistern monks in Burgundy and the production of wine in that area, there's some pretty good evidence that the use of the word terroir was really, really meant to be a mechanism by which a comparative advantage was achieved. And this had to do with festivals in Burgundy and or growing Pinot Noir or Chardonnay within that region as it was being marketed and sold throughout the rest of France and or Europe. So the idea there was is that there was a true, even back then, there was a true economic component to terroir that often isn't talked about. Yet today, we still have this very strong economic component, even though the Europeans have a tendency to look at it more as a cultural and physical kind of tie to the land and what they're producing. It's still used, especially in the New World, as a very, very strong economic marketing kind of component.
Uh-huh.
So if you look at it from the framework of a scientist, the influences of terroir on growing grapes and making wine are somewhat simplistic, but also very complex at the same time. Because we know that it's pretty basic. There's natural factors and cultural factors. Natural factors tend to be the climate, the soil, the geology, the landscape, and cultural factors tend to be how humans manage all of those relative to the vine that they're growing.
Right.
And so if you put that all together, that's kind of this whole kind of holistic terroir. But not everybody kind of sees it that way. Some people see it as terroir is really geology only. Some people see it as soil only. Some people see it as some kind of interaction between a few things, but not as a holistic kind of entity. And I tend to see it very holistically.
Mm. And it would make more sense, obviously, too, that way, considering that terroir could technically apply to anything and not just grapes.
Sure. Well, it does. And that's kind of another point is that the original, if you look back at kind of some of the root of the word, this idea, it's an area defined by its agricultural potential. And agricultural potential could be many things. And in Europe, you would look at this as being the potential based around cheeses, maybe breads, maybe sausages, maybe olive oil, maybe wine. All kinds of things are very potential in there. Now, there's a book out, and there's also a conference coming up. I've been involved with quite a few different terroir conferences and congresses. Matter of fact, I'm the president of the scientific committee for the one coming up in Burgundy and Champagne in 2012. But there's also a very good terroir meeting going on in California this coming summer, and it has to do with the terroir of wine and everything else. And I think the interest there lies in that there are true terroir influences for virtually everything. Coffee, chocolate, apples, honey, You name it. There's a gentleman by the name of Rowan Jacobson who's written a book called An American Terroir. It's a very good, simple read on some of the relationships behind these terroir influences for other things than wine. And he writes about kind of the terroir of different crops and even seafood, such as oysters in the Americas.
Wow.
And I would highly recommend it. It's a wonderful book in terms of looking at that. There's some history there and, of course, some geography. And of course, if you look at it, it's littered with climate influences.
Wow.
And that's what, you know, really sparks my interest, too. So, but anyway, this idea is that terroir really does influence a lot of different things. I always tell people when I give a talk to the general public about it, I relate it back to my grandmother. She lived in Kentucky, and I was born there, and I remember that she grew the best tomatoes and made the best pickles in the area, and I could never find better. I've never found better. And I asked her what made them so unique, and she said, "Well, you know, we've got good land here, and I tend to use very good seed bank, and you know, I take care of it, and I put a little love into it." And so that right there, in and of itself, kind of describes what terroir is all about. It was the climate and the land and the soil and how she cared for it that produced the best tomatoes, tomato juice, pickles, so on and so forth from her garden.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, everybody probably has a little kind of background, especially our generation, you know, that grew up in middle to the end of this last century, where we had a real much greater tie to the landscape and farming than we do today. People today, that concept of kind of where stuff comes from is just not quite so well ingrained, and therefore the relationship with terroir is much less.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of going back to it, you know, this idea of how it relates to wine is that there were some clear economic comparative advantage issues that came up out of Burgundy years ago, hundreds of years ago, for developing the concept of terroir. Now, one of the issues, and if you look at France and even parts of the old world as well, that developed in Europe that is so different than how it developed in the new world, is that if you go around Europe, all of the varieties that are being grown are typically being grown in very specific areas, and they're typically not grown anywhere else.
Right.
So, for example, in France, if you're in the Burgundy or Chablis region, you're growing Pinot Noir and in Chablis, Chardonnay. Mm-hmm. Now, by law, part of that comparative advantage is that there is nowhere else in France that legally can grow Pinot Noir and you, of course, can't call it Burgundy or a Burgundian type of wine.
Right.
But I can tell you from a climatologist standpoint, there's more places in France that can grow Pinot Noir and Chardonnay than simply in Chablis and Burgundy.
I'm sure.
And so what's happened, I mean, you take the New World experience from this, is that when grapes started being planted in the New World, whether it be South Africa or South America or Australia, New Zealand, or the United States, people recognized that there could be widely geographically separated areas that might have very similar climates that might be able to grow Pinot Noir. So there was no varietal limits being placed upon what you could grow.
Right.
And so we have this different way in which we have kind of developed our industry. We don't do it as a structural control so that those products coming from that region are unique to that region and nowhere else.
Which is even better.
Well, you know, it's...
I think.
I don't know.
all
I know is that there's clear usages of terroir that are both very real and very tied to economics.
Mm-hmm.
And as a scientist, the thing that really interests me is that can we, from a science perspective, understand some of the influences of terroir? And while we can make a list and say that, you know, these physical factors and these cultural factors are extremely important, the challenges are is that it's really hard to study them well enough so that we, you know, unequivocally know what those influences are everywhere. And it really is difficult. This is a great example. You've heard of the term minerality.
Yes.
You know, so a wine has minerality. Well, what is minerality? There's been this conversation about this for a long time, and you know, the idea is that some would say the minerality comes from the nature of the geology in the region. Well, you know, the hard thing about that is that there's been no proof that mineral characteristics in wine come from any minerals in the soil. It just doesn't happen. You can't get a geophysical process to create that, or at least we don't know what it is, if there is one. So minerality is this kind of magical thing that happens in some regions more than others. It may come about from the variety, its relationship to the soil, maybe how it's being fermented. Does it use natural yeast, or does it have yeasts that are added to it? What kind of fermentation process does it have? So there could be all kinds of things tied in there that influence this concept of minerality, which a lot of people tie back to terroir.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just one example of it. Another one, you know, potentially could be that, you know, one type of climate structure versus another drives aspects of terroir. And this is where I think that there's some fairly clear kind of characteristics. The idea there is that you could have the exact same type of soil or a very similar geology, very similar soil, but completely different climates, and you're going to get a completely different character from that wine.
Right.
A classic example would be Syrah. A cool climate Syrah tends to be much more peppery, while a warmer climate Syrah tends to be much more jammy and very fruit forward. And so what's driving that is that the soil's not driving that. It's the nature of the climate and where that fruit is being ripened. And there's been some work out of Australia recently that has found that there's a compound in Syrah or Shiraz called rotodone, and this compound is very prominent in the early ripening stages of Syrah in a cooler climate. When you're in a warmer climate, this compound tends to be metabolized off, and it doesn't show up as being as prevalent. So over given areas, you can have very different types of Syrah, just depending on if the grapes are grown at a higher elevation where it's cooler or a lower elevation where it's warmer.
Wow.
And so just that in and of itself says how important climate is to characteristics of wine flavor, texture, whatever, that are often attributed back to terroir.
Right.
I'm sorry?
No, I'm going to comment about climate then. So since climate is such a big influence, then that would seem to be the driving factor behind just about everywhere. I mean, we talk to people from all over the country, and we're always saying, well, we have the same climate and the same soil as France, or we have the same climate, right, and same soil, and you know, and this is always a comparison there. But
sure.
Influence of just a little bit of climate change, though, can make such a large difference as opposed to just the soil.
Well, and you know, that's important. I think that there's a lot of things in the statement that you just said that are important to kind of pull out. First of all, it's really hard for science to kind of tweeze out what's the most important factor. There's been a lot of little pieces of research that clearly point to climate being the kind of the first cut, so to speak. There's been some work out of Bordeaux, a little bit of work in Australia, South Africa, you know, that tends to show that climate and vintage kind of variability in that climate is the major driver. Then there's this kind of interactive relationship between soil and geology and variety that become very important in what's most important. But, you know, does science have a perfect little matrix where we can put in numbers and say, well, climate contributes 50% of the terroir effect, mm-hmm. and soil does 22%, and geology does 18%, you know, that kind of thing? No, we really don't have that, but we do know that climate is the big piece of that. I think that over time, as we become more and more in tune with understanding how to either observe or manage the data that we can get from vineyards and analyze it, we'll get better and better at trying to tweeze out that number. But that's kind of the idea. We don't know the numbers. We just know that climate typically is the bigger piece of it. The other piece of in your statement that I think is important is that this broad general comparison between Europe, the old world, and the new world, wherever it may be.
Yes.
You know, as a climatologist, I look at data, and if you look at data, you find pretty quickly that those comparisons are quite wrong. What happens is we have this tendency to look at analogs of climate and or latitude kind of zones of climate. So, for example, we could say that the latitude of Bordeaux is pretty similar to the latitude of a given place in the western United States or in New Jersey or wherever you want to say that. But the problem with that is that those latitudinal bounds are, of course, correct in terms of where they are, but it's the influence of the geography of that region that is more important. So, for example, the way I look at Europe is this kind of quasi-Mediterranean type of climate, and we have similar Mediterranean types of climates throughout the world. However, the word there is they're similar. They're not the same.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason is that Europe has essentially two large bodies of water that influence it, and the water temperatures in those two large bodies of water are higher than they are for most grape-growing regions in the rest of the world.
Uh-huh.
And the main issue is that if you go to Europe, you will find that the climate there is more humid, much more moisture in the atmosphere than it is in the western U.S. or parts of South Africa or parts of Australia. And they tend to get much more rainfall throughout their growing season in most places than anywhere else in the rest of the world. So the issue, there's quite a few different things that come out in there. Number one, the Europeans tend to not use irrigation, kind of a historic kind of thing. They haven't used irrigation because largely they don't have to. If you take your annual rainfall and it's pretty much spread throughout every month of the year, then you have enough rainfall to grow a crop.
Ah.
If you go to a place like Napa and you look at its annual rainfall, it gets less than 10% of it, or somewhere around 10% of it, in its growing season. Bordeaux gets about 60% of theirs. So Napa has to irrigate to do the same thing. Yet some people in Europe might look at it as being, well, if you irrigate, then you're an industrial terroir. That term is used.
Is it?
Out there in the media, yeah.
I've never heard that term. Yeah.
It's industrial or not natural.
Yeah.
So the issue there is that many places in the New World, which are in true, real dry Mediterranean climates, can't do the same thing that they can do in Europe because Europe is more humid and has more rainfall during the growing season.
Uh-huh.
So the classic example here is Bordeaux and Napa. A lot of people, Bordeaux and Napa are exactly the same. I would say hogwash.
Yeah, absolutely hogwash.
Yeah. You go to Bordeaux and you sweat. And wherever you sweat, it's because there's high humidity.
Right.
You go to Napa and it can be 100 degrees and you don't sweat.
You don't sweat. You're right.
Or you really can't. You really can't tell that you're sweating because it evaporates so quickly. The big issue there is that there's more ambient moisture in the atmosphere in Bordeaux than there is in Napa. What that does is that it does tremendous differences in the overall climate. Number one, the heat accumulation in Bordeaux doesn't get anywhere near the same number as it does in Napa. So therefore, the climate is completely different. And it gets there in completely different ways. In Bordeaux, high humidity levels mean that the daytime temperatures don't get anywhere near as high as they do in Napa. The maximum temperature records in Napa are typically somewhere between 10 and 15 degrees Fahrenheit more than they are in Bordeaux.
Wow.
It's kind of the same. Where are you located?
We're in Florida.
You're in Florida. Okay. So, great example. What's the maximum temperature record in Florida?
You know, inland probably breaks 100, but along the coast, it never does.
Okay. What's the maximum temperature record in parts of California? 115, 118.
If not higher.
The reason that occurs is that higher levels of moisture in the atmosphere do not allow the maximum temperature to get very high. It's a process of latent heat and moderating of that temperature effect. So in Bordeaux, maximum temperatures don't get anywhere near as high as they do in Napa. So therefore, Napa has more evapotranspiration and needs more irrigation.
Uh-huh.
Then nighttime temperatures are another thing. In Bordeaux, because it's a fairly moist atmosphere, nighttime temperatures don't drop as low. And Napa, nighttime temperatures drop much more low. You know, go back to Florida, where you are in Florida versus where I am in Oregon. Mm-hmm. You have high nighttime temperatures because it's humid there.
Right, yes.
I have low nighttime temperatures here in Oregon most of the year because I have no moisture in the air. We have very low humidity relative to what you experience. Same thing is going on in Napa. So Cabernet Sauvignon, which does its magical things in Napa and in Bordeaux, same thing with Merlot and other varieties as well, okay, is doing it actually in a very different environment. In Bordeaux, you have low daytime temperatures, high nighttime temperatures, and you don't accumulate as much heat. You have rainfall during the growing season. In Napa, you have high daytime temperatures, low nighttime temperatures. You accumulate more heat, but because it's very dry, you have to irrigate, and you don't have enough rainfall to have it be naturally irrigated.
The question arises, though. I'm in the wine business. I grow grapes. I do, and I talk to people and all that. But it's always that nighttime cooling down that concentrates that sugar into the fruit. And you're saying that the Bordeaux region doesn't have that great difference. So what is the concentration of sugar? Where do they get that sugar in the fruit to create these great, robust Cabernets and Merlots?
This is a conundrum. And I think that there's some definite things to kind of think about relative to this. So let's just kind of go back to it. Number one, I didn't say that it never cooled down at night at Bordeaux.
You just said they get as cool.
It doesn't get anywhere near as cool. So let's just do some – I know the numbers because I've done research in both places. Let's just look at the somewhere in the ripening period, let's say late August, early September in both places. In Napa, you're likely going to have a daytime temperature of 95 and a nighttime temperature of, say, 55.
Right.
Something like that. That's pretty common. Maybe 60 or something like that.
Yeah, maybe not.
Bordeaux. Yeah, in Bordeaux, you're going to have a daytime temperature of, let's say, 90 and a nighttime temperature of 65, or maybe even 70, depending on how much moisture is in the air. So the difference there is that the nighttime temperatures still drop down in Bordeaux. They just don't drop down anywhere near the same.
Uh-huh.
So what you're getting is you're getting a very different diurnal temperature range. Now, this is the conundrum with this. The issue there is that... we often hear this idea that you've got to have cool nighttime temperatures to produce a high-quality wine. I don't think that that's necessarily the case universally across all varieties and across all climates.
Hmm.
I think that there's some clear ties there, but it's also very, very different. So here's the issue I think that shows up with Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot and Cabernet Franc and all of those varieties that have a high concentration of methoxypyrazine. Do you know what that compound is?
No, I don't.
Methoxypyrazine is the compound that typically results in the green bean, bell pepper characters in a slightly underripe Cabernet, Merlot, Cabernet Franc.
Right.
Okay, so it's a compound that occurs in large quantities in that fruit. Now, what happens as time goes on in the ripening process, the cooler climates tend to not respire or metabolize those compounds off, while the warmer climates have a tendency to respire those compounds and end up producing a wine that tastes more ripe. That kind of goes back to this concept of hang time. What hang time is supposed to mean is that somebody is waiting for flavor.
Right.
And typically what they're doing is they're waiting for some flavors to leave as much as they're waiting for other flavors to occur.
Uh-huh.
And so the issue with Bordeaux and Napa and methoxypyrazine and that ripening process is that they both do virtually the same thing, but they just get there completely different.
Uh-huh.
In Bordeaux, it happens from a high nighttime temperature where respiratory processes occur further into the nighttime than they do in Bordeaux, or than they do in Napa. And in Napa, it happens from high daytime temperatures.
Uh-huh.
And so you're just getting there in two different ways. Now, we don't have absolutely perfect scientific evidence of that, but there's pretty clear kind of connections. And I think, you know, coming up in the future, we'll know more and more about that, definitely. But, you know, you can say the same thing. Let's think about the difference between Burgundy and Bordeaux. The main climatic difference between the two is that Bordeaux tends to be more maritime, with more moisture in the atmosphere, while Burgundy tends to be more continental and typically has lower temperatures and less maritime effect.
Drier.
So the difference there is that Cabernet does one thing in Bordeaux and Pinot Noir does another thing over in Burgundy. Pinot Noir, if you were to put it into Bordeaux, would not have a tendency to produce the same kind of fruit because Pinot Noir doesn't need high nighttime temperatures.
Right.
They have less of a methoxypyrazine issue, and what they're looking for there is some of those delicate aromas that develop in cooler nighttime temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to take Bordeaux, Cabernet Sauvignon, and move it over to Burgundy, you could arguably ripen it there, but it would be very few years out of 10. And probably what would happen is that you would end up most of the time having more methoxypyrazine because the daytime temperatures wouldn't be high enough and the nighttime temperatures would be too low.
Ah.
So a tremendous number of kind of interaction things are going on relative to this that cause climate in one place versus another to be producing very different results. Now, going back to how I originally started all the conversation with this is that Napa and Bordeaux, they do the same thing, but they get there completely differently in terms of how they're doing it. But it still goes back to this issue that when someone says the climate, the latitude is this, and then the climate is comparable, it's really mostly hogwash because it's not.
And then whenever anyone says that to me, I will not tell them it's hogwash. I will just nod my head and say, oh.
Well, that's what typically happens, is that there's a lot of, okay. You know, the main point is that you can make a statement and say, the conditions that I have here allow me to ripen my fruit in a very similar way.
Uh-huh.
Or to a similar degree than it does in another place. So let's go to another variety that you may or may not be familiar with, but Tempranillo.
Oh, yes.
Tempranillo is a historic Spanish, Portuguese, Iberian varietal that you know, really hasn't gained quite as much favor in different places in the world as have some French varieties and or even German or Italian varieties. But Tempranillo is a very interesting variety that tends to need a different climatic signature than Cabernet or Merlot or Pinot Noir. You typically don't grow that Tempranillo to the same quality standards you would like as they do in Rioja or Ribera del Duero in places that are suitable to Cabernet or Pinot. And the reason is that Tempranillo really needs moderate temperatures, not overly hot temperature, but moderate temperatures, and it needs to be ripened just as the climate is or the weather or the diurnal temperature range during ripening is starting to truncate to the end of the season. You can't ripen Tempranillo in a place that's really hot because it's just going to end up producing a very inferior wine. Typically it doesn't have all the flavors and characteristics. Some of this was found out in California years ago. One of the big questions might be that why doesn't California grow more Tempranillo due to its Spanish heritage than it does today?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting puzzle. If you think about it, Tempranillo makes up less than 1% of the acreage in California.
Yeah, very little. You find it more so all around the country in different areas than you do in any of California. That's true.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's some history behind this, and I think part of it is that some of the early trials of Tempranillo that were done in California were probably done either or in the wrong place or with the wrong clone. And so some of the early kind of decisions on whether Tempranillo was suitable to California came about because it just wasn't in the right place or the material wasn't very good. Now, one of the big things I think that happened is it wasn't in the right place. There are places in California that could do Tempranillo very good, I think, because of either elevation or coastal zone location. But typically, California does better in places like Oregon and Washington than it does in California because the climates are cool, the climates are more moderate, and the season truncates the way Tempranillo likes to ripen. So again, there's another thing. Is the climate of a place in Washington and Oregon similar to that in parts of Spain? Yes, you can find those. But are they identical? Not really, but they're close.
And the climate has... begs the question to... When I talk to different wineries around the country, around there, and in Oregon, for example, just southern Oregon, in your home there, I hear people saying, I'm growing Cabernets, I'm growing Merlots, I'm growing Tempranillo, and I'm growing Syrah, and I'm growing... All these grapes really do take a little bit different climate, a little bit different to produce the ultimate quality. So
Sure. Are
they all, the ones that will grow great there and then the ones that are marginal, they're really not doing it justice, from what I understand you're saying.
Well, there's so much tied into this in the New World, especially. You know, as people develop wine regions in the New World over the past, 50 to 100 years, and even today, a lot of what they plant is, I look at it as there's really kind of two avenues of people planting. There's a large group of people who are really looking at choosing the best sites, finding out what the best match is between varieties and climate. Many of them are doing experimentation, trying to understand what that really looks like and how it works. But there's also a whole another group of people that tend to plant what their favorite grape is or their favorite wine is.
Yes.
And I think what happens then is that we have a tremendous amount of mismatches between what variety does best in a region versus what somebody, wants to drink. You know, you should never plant what you want to drink in a given site. What you should do is you should find the site that allows you to plant what you want to drink.
Right.
That's really what it comes down to. If you force the issue, you're not going to be as successful as when you actually choose the site to grow the variety that you want. So you end up getting a lot of different things that happen within wine regions over time. And the other piece of this is tied to market. I mean, let's just take a variety like Nero Diavola, great Italian variety. But could I bring it into a given wine region in the United States, plop down and put 1,000 acres in and make the wine and then have a market for it?
Probably not.
Probably not as successful as I would have plopped down 1,000 acres of Cabernet and forced it to produce a wine.
Right.
I probably could sell my wine, even though it might not be quite as good. I could probably sell that wine on the marketplace because of the name recognition.
Right.
So we have a marketplace issue as well. The other thing that's happened in the New World, and we really have to kind of think about this, because I think Napa is a great example, parts of Sonoma is another good example, Southern Oregon is a great example, places in Washington and Idaho are good examples of this. Some of our wine regions are fairly large, have a reasonable amount of topography, and have a tendency to have more diverse climate structures in them than anywhere in the Old World.
Right.
So, just for example, here in Southern Oregon, part of one of our challenges here is that we can grow from a climatically suitable kind of framework, varieties ranging all the way from the ultra-cool Gewürztraminer of Merlot-Thurgau's to Cabernet Sangiovese on the warmest of sites. So the challenge with a wine region then is that what do you become known for? And how many people kind of hone in on that, and how many people are experimenting? Some of the work that I've done here in this area kind of points to the fact that we probably have as many as 70 to 75 varieties planted in Southern Oregon.
Wow.
Now, many of them are in experimental stages that people are trying to figure out what works. But there's still probably maybe 25 to 30 of them that are doing really well. So then what happens at the marketplace when wines from Southern Oregon have this huge range of potential? And I'm talking about very good wines that come from them. And so what ends up happening is that there's less regional recognition in the marketplace because there's a greater diversity of potential.
And that's what's happening in New York State right now, too. I've always said this. New York can grow so many different varieties of grapes, and they're not noted for any particular grape.
Yeah, and so what happens in a place like New York, you've got a regionality that comes about. Of course, the Finger Lakes are a much cooler climate region. They tend to be more focused toward Riesling and other varieties in that spectrum. Come down to Long Island, a little bit more Bordeaux varieties. The Hudson Valley, a little bit different too. So you got some real differences. And Oregon's the same way. From where I live, which is basically a few miles from the California border, to Portland, we basically cover the gamut of the same varieties that grow from the south of France in Provence to the north of France in Chablis and Burgundy. And so just over a very small region like that, here we have this huge difference. So Northern Oregon, the Willamette Valley, is known for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and Riesling and some other cool climate varieties. And the rest of the state is known for Syrah, Tempranillo, and other warm climate varieties.
Right. One other question I do want to ask you here, and we've talked about climate and all that, climate warming. The effects on regions. Now, I've always had the thought, and I've read that Napa is going to lose its perfect weather and temperature because of climate warming. It will be moving up actually to Southern Oregon and stuff like this. What is your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, the basics are is that, you know, climates change all the time. We've known throughout Earth's history climates change, and so as a species we tend to deal with climate change in different ways. Of course, you know, thousands of years ago, climate was probably one of our biggest issues because we just had to survive. I mean, hunters and gatherers, hunted and gathered where they could find livelihoods and live. And the issue today is that our ways of life are much more static. All of our systems are static. I mean, everything we do is very static. We plop ourselves down and we do what we do in this area, and we expect it to be the same. Now, the problem is that it's not supposed to be the same. That's not the way Earth operates. You know, there are earthquakes, there are volcanoes, there are all kinds of other events that happen, and then climate doesn't stay the same. So we should never expect it to stay the same, except our systems today kind of expect it.
Mm.
So we're really kind of in a pickle, and there's plenty of other issues that are tied around it. First of all, you know, you and I are living in a time right now that we're very focused on our own basic survival within that time, which typically means do we have a good job? Are we interested in what we do with our work? Do we provide for our families? How do we proceed in our life? And so we're typically operating on a very short-term kind of framework.
Right.
Even if our lifetimes, you know, range from, you know, 70 to 90 years, it doesn't matter. It's still short-term. So we're very focused on this short-term kind of suite of issues, and long-term climate change doesn't mean quite as much to us. And that's kind of a real challenge, because climates historically have changed over the long term, but what we've seen of late is showing that climates are changing much more rapidly on the short term than we ever imagined.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's pretty straightforward. If you look back at the evidence for many different things we have, not just growing grapes and making wine, but many things, climates have influenced how and where things could be done, whether it be agriculture or just industrial developments and or migration of peoples and or lots of different societal issues.
Right.
So climate change, in terms of what it does to growing grapes and making wine, means that very small changes could potentially mean very large differences. And one of the classics people point to is the idea that back in the medieval optimum, where climates were as close as they've ever been to being as warm as they are today, grapes were planted over most of Europe, especially in the northern reaches. And from the medieval period, in that 13th, 14th century period, into the Little Ice Age, the vast majority of everything planted north of where it is today died out.
Uh-huh.
And so there was a clear climate change signal then that took viability in places like England, northern France, northern Germany, the Low Countries, so on and so forth, took that viability and wiped it out.
Hmm.
And so, you know, in the 1800s or so, we went to this place where there was a contraction of viticulture throughout the old world. And if you go to today, from the 1800s to today, what we've seen is we've seen some very rapid climate change. We've seen places that typically were right at the margins of viticulture, right at the margins of cool climate viticulture, barely warm enough to ripen cool climate varieties, to today being much more suitable to those varieties and even more suitable to varieties that need more heat.
Mm. Right.
So there's plenty of evidence that shows this. And so the real question, I think, comes down to us. We're operating in this world today. We're managing our vineyards and our vines to produce a given product today. And there's this big if. If climates continue to change, as the best science today is telling us that they will continue to change, then we have potential issues. You can't continue to grow Pinot Noir in a place that becomes suitable to Cabernet.
Right.
It just will not be the same. And so when does that happen? Does it happen next week? No. Does it happen 2 years from now? No. Does it happen down the road into the next generation? Very likely. Do Do I or any other scientists know when that will happen and what those thresholds are? No, because it's kind of a moving window. It's how do people adapt? How do we adapt our vineyards and our winemaking to produce what we're producing? What is the true threshold that Pinot Noir can be no longer grown in a given region, or that you have to shift to a warmer climate variety, or you have to go higher in elevation? The exactness of all that is not known yet, but we can do what-if scenarios. So, and I'll just use Pinot Noir as an example. We know from looking at climates worldwide that Pinot Noir grows over about a 2 degrees Celsius or a 4 degree Fahrenheit climate niche. It's not grown outside that niche. If it is, it's not going to ripen and or it's gone into bulk fruit. It's just not going to produce a quality product. So if what we know about history is correct, and we look at this as kind of our benchmarks for how Pinot Noir has been grown, then if you're within this kind of climate niche, and let's say it warms by 2 degrees Celsius or 4 degrees Fahrenheit, and pushes you outside of what we've historically known.
Right.
So something has to happen. Either major adaptive responses have to be done to continue to allow Pinot Noir to grow in ways we've never known it to grow before. Or you have to shift to another variety or move your operation to find the climate that's suitable to Pinot Noir.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's kind of, again, going back to that big if. If what we know today and throughout history has been correct, then future warming of X means this.
Okay.
And so this happens across all varieties, all regions. Some regions have been warming more rapidly than others. Some are projected to warm more rapidly than others. And so those kinds of changes are out there. And, you know, the unknowns are, I think, more associated with how much climate will change rather than will it change.
Uh-huh. So it's a matter of adoption. I mean, we will adapt to what we need to adapt to.
Well, and because there's so much economics tied into it today, we will. There clearly will be adaptation. Now, the question is, what mechanisms are out there? Would it be vineyard management, irrigation strategies, different vine material, genetics, plant breeding? There's not one magical little thing. It's got to be a portfolio, likely, of things that will occur.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have to do it today, tomorrow, next week, next year? No, but I tell you what, if you're in agribusiness of any kind, you don't do everything the exact same way every year anyway.
Right.
You adapt to what those conditions are. If you're in a given region and you're growing wheat and you go into a drought, you're going to go to a more drought-tolerant wheat species.
Right.
If you don't, you're going to be out of business. So I think agribusiness is a very adaptable, and I think we have a strong potential in any agribusiness, and I think the wine industry has a strong potential as well. What happens in research often is that we produce these results that say things like, you know, Napa will be reduced by X percentage over in the future. Well, that's the results of the data and the analysis, but it often we don't have all of the pieces of the puzzle in there, especially the ones about how we adapt. Is there a lot of adaptive potential? Yes. What are those adaptions, and do we adopt them in a timely and efficient manner? Those are the big questions that have to be answered over time.
Mm-hmm. Well, fascinating. I can let you go on and on. I understand you have a class, though, that you have to get to.
Yeah, I've got a class coming up that I need to go get prepared for and teach. So.
Oh.
Mike, you have any questions for...
I was checking emails and everything. I do have something come in here asking if air quality... let's see how this is where it went to. Is air quality a factor or an important factor that affects plant growth as well?
Yes, it is. to different degrees, and there's probably two examples that I could mention. One is ozone, and the other one is smoke from fires. To talk about ozone first, a lot of photochemical processes that happen in the lower part of the atmosphere include how various hydrocarbons and sunlight interact to create ozone issues. And ozone can be very problematic for plants and even humans down near the surface in terms of how it affects respiration and or the stomatal conductance and airflow movement in a plant system. The uptake of CO2 is hindered, stomatal gets a little smaller. And so increased amount of hydrocarbons released by human activity could, and it has been seen in many places, to increase ozone, which in turn can stress plants. Now, do the plants produce different fruit and or different wine quality? We don't have all the answers in that puzzle, but it appears that if the plant's stressed, it's not going to produce the same volume and or typicity of wine. The other example that I gave was this idea of smoke. In many wine grape growing regions in the world, the relative dry summer climate tends to coincide with the fire season. And there has been a lot of work being done lately on what's called smoke taint. And the idea there is that if you have a pall of smoke over a given area from a fire for quite a few days, and maybe even weeks, then there appears to be the ability of the vine to uptake that, or maybe the fruit to uptake that, to a point that when the wine is made, there's potential for taint in the wine.
Wow.
There is a lot of research out of Australia and South Africa that's looking at smoke taint. And there's been some interesting technologies that have developed to use micro filtration, reverse osmosis, those kind of things to try to remove smoke taint from wine. And it appears to be relatively effective. There's still a lot of research going on. We still don't know exactly if a fire occurs early in the season, does it have the same effect as it does in the later part of the season? Does the smoke have the same influence? And it appears that it's a little different, that certain times of the growth cycle of the vine, it can take up more of that smoke characteristic.
Wow. I hadn't heard that. That's interesting.
Now, I have to make, there's one caveat with that, though, is that often we hear that when we smell or taste a wine, we say it's smoky or earthy.
Right.
That right there, it has nothing to do with smoke taint. That has to do with typically some characteristic of that variety and the barrel that's been used to age it in, producing kind of a more tobacco-y, smoky kind of character. Smoke taint is very different.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. I hadn't heard of smoke taint. That's a term, but I can understand that with all the wildfires and everything happening that we hear every summer. It's an interesting point.
Very good.
Anything else, Mike?
No. You covered the what I was going to ask about as far as the trend in climates and Napa Valley and everything. So, yeah, we're good.
Greg, thank you very much mm-hmm. for being on the program with us today. It was phenomenal. I was looking forward to listening to you, and I'm glad I did. I'm glad you were able to join us on the show because it was very informative and quite enlightening. And best of luck to you. And, you know, it's day in the future, I may call you again and say, hey, would you like to do another segment? Because you were really, really informative. I enjoyed our program today.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And take care of yourself, and hopefully I'll be talking to you in the future.
Okay, take care.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right. Very You know what? We didn't get the contact information on his website.
Oh, well, let me get that. And you're right. He had a class, and I was just
I saw that.
Jumping into it. Let me. I've got some information here. Let me find it here. Here it is. If anyone wants to get a hold of him, let me give you an email address instead of a phone number. Let me give you his email address. It's GJONES, G Jones, as in Gregory Jones, at SOU, and that's Southern Oregon University, SOU.edu. So G Jones at SOU.edu. And you can get a hold of him. Fascinating. I love the program today. It was it was very enlightening.
Yeah, definitely.
And I could have let him go on and on for much longer, too, if he didn't have a class. But I'm glad he was able to join us. And I will get a hold of him in the future, see if maybe he might have some other time to join us and talk some more.
Yeah, I'm glad he stayed on as long as he did. I mean, when I got him on, there was some concern about, you know, the timing and everything. And I thought, he says, well, you know, maybe 30 minutes, maybe 45.
Oh, yeah.
This is good. I'm glad.
Yeah. He's as bad as I am. I start teaching my class, and I tell people it's going to run from 2 to 5, and then usually about 5:15, I say, well, if you got to leave, but I still got more things to say.
You know? Yeah. It's him running into class real quick. He's late. I had to do a show.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Or his TA runs in there and says, he'll be here soon. Just hang on.
Yeah. Where are you?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I enjoyed listening to him. Just some great information. I'm going to have to listen to him on archives again, because there's just no way I was able to pick up all the stuff. And I was trying to make notes and everything else.
I was too, and I was like, oh, man, there's a lot of...
Yeah, I mean, he'd say one thing, you want to write it down, he'd start saying something down, and go, I missed that. So, yeah. So I'm going to have to pop him in on archives and listen to him there.
Yeah, so. Definitely. Very good show, and it's different for us being on this time of the day, and, you know, we make arrangements for that, so, you know, if you'd like to be a guest on our show on All About Wine, and our 7 p.m. Thursday time slot doesn't work for you, you know, let us know and we'll see what we can do. I mean, we made arrangements for this. It was very, very well done, and great to have him on. So, you know,
very
absolutely. Email the show. Very cool. Yeah, I got about almost a page here, too.
I do, too. I've got a little over a page, actually, of notes here on him.
Scribbling down information and...
And to reiterate what Mike just said there about being on the show, if you're in a different country or something, we can accommodate you just about any time. I mean, it's, you know, you don't have to be up at, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning to join us on the program. We can take care of you any time. So,
if you have Skype, it'd be even easier. We can, we can hit you up on Skype and bring you into the show that way. We can work something out. And we still have that, who was that lady, woman down in Australia?
We got a lady down in Australia. We're going to be getting on the air this summer winter. I say summer winter because she's behind us, and so they're summer now. We're winter, so
Is winter. Oh, okay.
This is winter.
Okay. Yep. Again, 75 degrees. This is our winter.
It's our winter.
When he was talking about something with the air quality was kind of interesting, because, you know, if you're on the same latitude as he was talking about as Bordeaux, but in the west, you know, I wrote something down on that effect that, you know, you're still not growing or not able to grow the same as they are in Bordeaux, it sounded like. And I was, you know, just for the heck of it, I tried to find air quality in Europe. I found Bordeaux. And it breaks it down to the different pollutants that are in the air, and it tells you what the rating is. And I'm looking at that, and everything is very low in Bordeaux right now. Hey, that rhymed. Everything is low in Bordeaux right now. But then you go over to Napa Valley on the government site, air quality government site, and theirs is a moderate 62, and it's expected to go up to as high as 77 today. And I'm thinking, this isn't the growing season, though, is it?
No.
I'm just wondering if there was any kind of statistic done as to, you know, the different regions and why, you know, if it's failing in Napa, you know, along with climate, does air quality play a factor into that? And, you know, if this trend continues, if Bordeaux continues to have, you know, low levels, but Napa continues to have moderate to high levels, well, actually, tomorrow's supposed to be good. But anyway, I'm just saying, is that an effect on the plant itself? And
it has,
you know,
to be.
Like, yeah.
It has to be. Like everything, from what he was saying, I mean, everything mm-hmm. has to be some influence on the plant.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah. I mean, even minute things and small things, everything, from what I gather from what he was saying, everything mm-hmm. will have an influence.
Yeah.
Not as great as others, but yet there is that yeah. influence there.
Yeah. And surprisingly, I'm looking at Tampa's air quality, and it says good today. So,
oh.
That is a shock.
we just had the rain go through, and that cleans up a little bit.
Yeah, it's like I think it shows 32 here and 62 Napa and like 24, 0 to 25 in Bordeaux, France. So, yeah, it's so just a little range there. Maybe we should have like a little ticker, have a ticker going across with all the air qualities and the
air
climate.
Quality.
So, but, you know.
Compared to
yeah. So, yeah, very interesting. But, wow. Very
yeah.
informative show. That was cool.
And, you know, I left it open, too, for our sequel. You know, hopefully,
yeah.
your date might be able to get him on again. So that,
yeah. Yep.
He's just too informative not to be able to get on for another program sometime. So
Right. Very cool.
Yeah, right. It was.
Well, we know we have listeners out there tuning in on the archives, and this was a featured program today. Thank you very much, Blog Talk Radio, for doing that. I appreciate
yeah.
that. And,
yes.
Okay,
yes.
Hey,
thank you, Blog Talk Radio.
Bus people finally. Okay, stop. Bus people finally woke up. So came out of their you know, little slumber with their headphones on. Oh, yeah, they're talking about us. Yeah, very, very good. Thank you for doing that. And we'll probably see the numbers spike on this one. We will replay this show. What are we looking at? Next week, probably?
Yeah, not tomorrow night, but next Thursday.
Yeah. Next Thursday, we'll do a repeat at our regular time slot. So if you're, you know, local, this isn't a good time for you because you're on lunch break and it's not that long of a lunch break, you can catch it next Thursday. We'll reprogram it and put it back in. So there'll be a replay next Thursday. Tomorrow on the show, I have looks like we have two guests tentative for tomorrow. We'll need to confirm them from Southern Oregon. Let's see, Caprice Vineyards and Winery,
correct.
And from Carlock, Illinois, White Oak Vineyards with Rudy and Mary. We'll see if we can get them scheduled in and put them on the show tomorrow. So it'll be kind of a mix between Oregon and Illinois.
Yeah, a little variety there.
Yeah. There we go. Now we're mixing it up.
Now we're mixing it up, yeah.
Yeah.
So tune in. Probably. Listen to us.
Yeah.
Give us a call. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you have any comments or questions for a future show or you want to be a guest on the show, email allaboutwine101@gmail.com. That's allaboutwine101@gmail.com. That is the email address. Also, be sure to follow us on Facebook. You can like us on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. It's BTR as in Blog Talk Radio. So All About Wine BTR on Facebook. You can like us there. And I think we're up to 22 now. So
all right, yeah.
We're getting there.
I know.
We're getting there.
People are slowly joining. We just had a new one, so that's good.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a new thing, I guess, but you're posting, you know, a lot of show information on it. I've got it on my cell phone coming in. It's like, you know, All About Wine BTR just posted a new. And I was like, oh, good, you know. So I keep up to date on my phone all the time, so that's cool. But we have, I mean, just on Blog Talk Radio, we have thousands of listeners here, so I know there's plenty of you out there listening, and it's getting better. So shows like this and specials and everything, it's really a giant boost. But I forgot what we finished last year with, but I'll forget those
statistics. Close to 11,000.
Yeah, it was very big. And so we're looking forward to another great year, and this is a great, you know, couple of shows we've had already. So
right,
this is cool. So tomorrow, catch us at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's Thursday, Eastern, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll have hopefully two guests on as we complete Oregon, or we're just moving out of the south?
No, we're just moving out of southern Oregon. We'll be heading up to the Willamette Valley.
The what?
The Willamette.
Willamette.
The Willamette.
We'll find out from a real Willamette if...
if it's pronounced Willamette or Willamette.
Yes. And so we'll be on that part of that tomorrow. I mean, next... In 3 weeks, I guess, because next week will be the replay of this show. So,
right.
Which
so
you're probably hearing.
Weeks.
Yes. So if it's not Wednesday at 1:14 p.m. Eastern time on January the 18th, you're listening to it on Thursday. This is a repeat. So anything I'm telling you about future shows, yes.
Yeah. So if you start figuring out the future dates. This,
Oh, my God, they're playing this again next Thursday?
Well, we know not to listen to this. It's not important.
So the 19th, tomorrow, we'll have a regular show live, 7 p.m. Eastern time. And then the 26th of January, Thursday, you will hear this show. Cool.
All right.
That's it. I just looked that up. Had to get it confirmed. All right. Thank you all for listening and appreciate it. Thank you, Ron. It was very interesting, as always.
Thank you.
And we will see everybody back here live again tomorrow, Thursday, at 7 p.m. as we continue with All About Wine in 2012. Thank you all for listening, and you all have a great rest of the day and tomorrow. We'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you all very much.
Yeah.